Let's go ahead and kick off another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We're currently looking at events that took place on the night of the Last Supper, and then the wee morning hours when Jesus was at Gethsemane, the place where he will be arrested. It is the 14th day of the first Jewish month, which is the day on which the Jewish people execute or kill their Passover lambs. Jesus and his apostles have gathered for their Last Supper on the evening of Thursday. The two apostles that he sent to prepare it would have butchered the lamb after the sun went down, which would have been roughly right around 6 o'clock. And then they would have cooked it for the next several hours. Jesus and the rest of the apostles would have arrived at the upper room probably after 8 o'clock or so. Supper would have commenced somewhere 9, maybe 10. So once everything was done and they were on their way to Gethsemane, it is almost certainly after midnight. Now, you remember that Jesus talked with them on the way from the upper room across the city of Jerusalem, perhaps stopping at the Temple Mount for a little prayer time. But he is talking to them about what's coming up soon. His death, his resurrection, the need that they have to be in Galilee to meet with him after his resurrection. Many of these things passed over their head. He told them that the Holy Spirit was going to help them out, going to provide divine recall of what they've already learned, plus additional information, and that they were going to need to remain in Jerusalem after all the other events in order to receive the supernatural gifting by the Holy Spirit. So all of that has already happened when Jesus then makes his way to the Garden of Gethsemane. Now keep in mind that the Garden of Gethsemane has to be somewhere on the road from the Temple Mount up and over the Mount of Olives to Bethany. It's about a 1.5 mile journey. So we're talking about the western side of the Mount of Olives. There is a traditional place that's been identified since the 300s of the Christian era that they will show to you as the Garden of Gethsemane. They'll even show you a rock inside this fancy church building called the Church of All Nations that they believe Jesus prayed upon on the evening of his betrayal. Now, that's all tradition, and I think it is probably incorrect as a location. First of all, there was no rock in the story that we're about to read. And second of all, I think there's every evidence that the Garden of Gethsemane is a place that Jesus stopped at habitually, and that is likely to be identified as the place from which he delivered the Olivet Discourse, which is specifically said to have an overlook of the Temple Mount. The Church of All Nations and the traditional Garden of Gethsemane is actually down in the Valley of the Kidron, and you can't see the Temple Mount from there. You can see the eastern wall of the Temple Mount, but that's it, nothing else. So I am of the opinion, and that's how I'm going to teach it, that the Garden of Gethsemane, the authentic one, is somewhere several hundred feet up the slope of the Mount of Olives toward the east, toward the crest, and that this is the place that Jesus is making his way to with the apostles. So with that in mind, we've got evidence, we've got testimony from all four Gospels regarding this garden. Let's start in John chapter 18. John 18:1 says, when Jesus had spoken these words, meaning the high priestly prayer of chapter number 17, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley. So he went out of Jerusalem, probably even out of the Temple Mount. And the Kidron Valley runs along the east side of the Temple Mount. And you go down into it and then back up again, following the path heading toward Bethany. So he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. So the garden is a pleasant place, as its name implies, but it is also a working garden. We're going to see in a moment from Matthew and Mark that it is called the Garden of Gethsemane, which means the Garden of the Oil Press. And it's olive groves that are all over this Mount of Olives. And so the oil that's being pressed out is olive oil. More than likely, now this is speculation on my part, I acknowledge, but more than likely, Jesus had already made arrangements that he and his disciples could habitually stop at this garden, probably walled in, and have some private time alone whenever they were walking back to the city of Bethany each night. And more than likely, again, this garden had a nice view of the Temple Mount off to the west. And Jesus is going to take his disciples here for a private time of prayer on this night of his betrayal. Now, verse 2 of John 18 gives us some more information. It says, "Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples." So that's, again, contributing to this idea that we're talking about a habitual place of prayer and pause on the way back to Bethany, and that the Garden of Gethsemane, in my opinion, should be equated with the site of overlook from which the Olivet Discourse was delivered. Now, Judas is going to catch up with Jesus at the Garden of Gethsemane, but it's going to be yet another couple of hours before he does that. Why does it take him so much time? Well, remember that he didn't know ahead of time exactly where they were going to meet for the upper room supper experience. So he could not betray him before the supper. The deal that he's struck with the leadership of the Sanhedrin is that he will identify a place where Jesus is away from the crowds with a minimal amount of persons around him, just his disciples. And then he can be arrested and taken into trial. So he couldn't, that is, Judas could not let them know ahead of time about the upper room. So he had to wait until he left the upper room. When he left, it wasn't very long after that that Jesus took his disciples away from the room off to the Garden of Gethsemane. So once Judas actually gets the arrest party, which may take him an hour or so, going back to the upper room, he's going to find the place deserted, empty. And then he's going to have to start thinking, well, where is the next probable place? And eventually, he will come to the conclusion, the Garden of Gethsemane is likely where we'll catch him next by himself. And that will be, as I've said, in the wee hours of the morning on Friday. Now, verse 3, since we're talking about Judas, let's just finish up what it says here. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there, that is to the garden, with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now let's correct a misunderstanding here that has been promulgated by many, many dramatists, many plays and cartoons and television made for television movie spectaculars. This band of soldiers are not Romans. The Romans will come into the story later. This is the temple police. The Jewish temple had a massive police force. If you can imagine, they've got hundreds of thousands of people coming to the Temple Mount every single day of the year. And during the festival times, it is a massive crush of people that are milling around in the area because they want to be part of the religious ceremonies. That's going to take a lot of security to help people get in and out properly and to put down fights that start, help find lost children and lost parents and things like that. So it is a detachment of the security temple police that Judas has made arrangements to take as the arrest party for Jesus. So let's get that in our heads correctly. It's all Jewish that will be trying to arrest Jesus on this night. Now, go to Luke 22, 39, and let's reinforce what we know. It says, he came out, that is, out of the city of Jerusalem, and went, as was his custom, there it is again, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, Luke doesn't name the place, but it is obvious from the context that follows, he's talking about the Garden of Gethsemane. Matthew says, 26:36, then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. So, place of the olive press. And then he's going to talk to his disciples. And then finally, let's land at Mark chapter 14, verse 32, which we're going to kind of use as the bones, the framework for what happens in the garden tonight. This is Mark 14, 32. They went to the place called Gethsemane. And then he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. So Jesus has 11 of his disciples with him. He arrives at this private garden, this working garden. And as they go into it, because it's probably walled in, he tells 9 of his apostles, excuse me, let's go back again, 8 of his apostles, you guys just settle down here at the edge of the garden. And then, verse 33 of Mark 14, he took with him Peter and James and John. So this is the inner circle again that he has been working with, been developing to be kind of the leaders of the rest. So Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, the two cousins of Jesus. And what does he do? He began to be greatly distressed and troubled. So he's very upset. Matthew actually has his wording here. This is Matthew 26, 38. My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And the word watch there has the idea of staying awake. Luke gives a little bit more depth to it as well. Luke 22, verse 40. Pray that you may not enter into temptation. So Jesus has 8 of his apostles near probably the entry point. He takes 3 of them a little deeper into this garden area. He tells them, you guys need to settle down right here. You need to stay awake and you need to be praying. And you need to be praying specifically that you don't fall into temptation. But also, you need to understand that I am feeling overwhelmed right now by what's about to happen. And I need you to be with me in prayer. This is back in back in 14, Mark 14, 34. He said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." Going a little farther, he fell on the ground. Notice, nothing mentioned about a stone, is there? So he falls on the ground. Matthew actually says he falls on his face. Luke talks about going about a stone's throw, not a really hard stone's throw, understand, but, you know, 50, 60 feet away. And then he kneels down. So it seems to have this picture for us, this mental picture that we should be developing here, that Jesus has the bulk of his apostles at the gate, his three inner circle apostles farther into the garden, and then he himself even farther from them, kneeling down, even getting down on his face and praying, because he is so overwhelmed with what's going on and what's about to happen. Now, what is about to happen? Well, he's about to be arrested, and he is about to be put on trial and mistreated, all the things that he's been prophesying. And then he is going to be crucified, which is a horrible way to be executed. But it's not the worst thing that's going to happen. Remember that this is all about Jesus atoning for sin. All of the sin guilt, all of the sin debt of everyone that has ever put their faith in God's salvation, and all those that will put their faith in God's salvation in the future. So from the beginning of sin to the second coming of Jesus, all of that sin, guilt, and debt is going to be laid on him in a moment's time. And he is going to bear it. He is going to take that burden on himself. And you can be guaranteed that that is a huge weight on his mind right now. Now, we have a hard time comprehending this. Jesus is 100% God. Let's make no bones about that. But in accordance with Philippians chapter number 2, he has divested himself of all of his divine prerogatives in some sort of agreement with the Father, that he would become 100% human being. And he will deal with temptation throughout his life as a human being, not as God. Book of Hebrews. He was tempted and tried unlike all of us, and yet he did it without sinning. So Jesus is the only human being, when faced with the temptation of sinning, continued to resist that temptation successfully. He did that as a human. And then, having passed that test, he now lays down himself as the atoning sacrifice for sin. And as a human, takes all of that debt upon himself, but as God, is able to do it miraculously, everybody's debt at the exact same moment. You know, it's an amazing thing, Paul writes this, for a person to die in order to save someone else, to die in the place of someone else. Imagine how absolutely amazing it is that one would die for billions and their sin. And so that's what Jesus is facing. That is what's weighing down on him. Back to Mark 14. It says that, verse 35, going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And this is what he said, Abba, which is Hebrew Aramaic for father. And so Mark actually gives us that. Abba, which means father. All things are possible for you. So everything is within God's ability. Remove this cup from me. Now, what cup is he referring to? Now, when I was a younger Christian, I was under the impression, and I'd kind of been taught this from a couple of different directions, that Jesus is praying that he can survive the momentary pressure of the stress that's going on here in the garden. That he's basically praying that he doesn't die before he gets to the cross. I have now come to the conclusion that that is not what he is praying over. The cup that he's praying about, I believe, based on the context that comes hereafter with the language, the cup that he's talking about is the cup of the atonement itself. Jesus is, in fact, asking God if it is possible that we can accomplish atonement without me taking all of this sin burden upon myself. Let's do it that way. But notice what he says next. Yet not what I will, but what you will. This gets back to the Philippians passage again. That Jesus, being in very form God, did not consider his equality with God something that he needed to cling to, something he needed to grab at so that it wouldn't slip out of his hands, the thing that he already had. But instead, he humbled himself, and he took on himself the form of a human, took himself the form of a servant. And being found in that form, he was obedient. Obedient even to the death on the cross. So even though Jesus is genuinely asking the Father, if it's possible for us to do this a different way, please, let's do it that way. He also acknowledges, but I will do whatever is necessary. Whatever you say, Father, needs to happen to save the people. And so, he spends some time praying. Now, we usually talk about an hour this or an hour that in our descriptions of this. And it's not like Jesus spends 3 hours praying here. It doesn't seem to be 3 hours. It seems as if he spends some very serious time praying, and then he goes to check in with his apostles that he left only a stone's throw away. So Mark tells that story next. And remember, when Mark tells the story, by tradition, it seems to be the preaching stories of Peter the Apostle. So this is Peter's recollection that Mark is passing on. Verse 37, so he came and he found them sleeping. Remember what he'd said, my soul is heavy right into the point of death. I'm grieving over this. I need you guys to watch and pray with me. You need to pray that you don't fall into temptation. And so after impressing on them how serious this time is, he goes away, prays, and comes back, and they're sleeping. And so he said to Peter, Shimon, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Now, again, I don't think we're talking about a literal hour here. I think it's that momentary thing. You couldn't even spend a few minutes with me? Verse 38, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Now, we are traditionally want to interpret that as his commentary on Peter and James and John's situation. That they really wanted to stay awake and pray with Jesus, but it was just so hard. Their bodies were weak. But I'd like to expand it to include himself. That Jesus is saying that his spirit is quite willing to go to the cross, to do what it takes to atone the peoples of all ages that have put their faith in God. But yet in his human side of the equation, his humanness, which he's 100% human as well, that side really doesn't want to go through what's about to happen, including the separation from the Father that he's always been one with. So I think he's not just simply telling them that they need to pray, but they need to pray for him to deal with what's going on right now. And so verse 39, again, he went away and he prayed, saying the same words. So we have a repeat, same thing. Father, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. This is Matthew's account, Matthew 26, 42. Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And then again, he came and he found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy. That's the language from both Matthew and Mark. Mark 14:40 says, and they did not know what to answer him. They were ashamed. They were embarrassed that they could not stay awake. And so Mark reports that he went away. We know this from the other passages. And then he came the third time. So this is back the third time after his prayer session. And he has some words to say to them. Now, Matthew 26, 45 says, when he came to the disciples this third time, he said to them, sleep, take your rest. Sleep and take your rest later on. The Mark 14, 41 says, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? So apparently you kind of merge that thought together there, is that basically Jesus wakes them up and says, you guys need to kind of knock it off with the sleeping. You can't sleep anymore. You'll have to sleep later because of this. It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. So after this time of intense prayer, three periods of intense prayer, Jesus informs his inner circle, the betrayer has arrived on the scene. And that's where we'll pick up the story the next time we get into the Word.